everyone. I'm Brandon Odo.
And I'm Brian Bowling.
And this is Critical Care Scenarios, the podcast where we use clinical cases, narrative, storytelling, and expert guests to unpack how critical care is practiced in the real world.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the podcast. Brian Bowling with you as usual. And with me is my co-host, co-podcaster, Brandon Odo.
Co-pilot. Hi, everyone.
Co-pilot, yeah. So today we're going to talk about something that many of you may not be familiar with or maybe haven't really thought about, and that's the topic of CPR-induced consciousness. So we have a guest with us to talk about this who is the author of a paper about this coming out, Jack Howard. Jack is joining us from Melbourne, Australia, where he's an intensive care paramedic at Ambulance Victoria and does some research around this. And this is a particular field of interest for him. And so we thought we'd have him on and talk about this as a concept and his paper. And Brandon's got a case we're going to go through.
Yeah. Welcome, Jack. Thanks for coming.
Thanks for having me, guys. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I'm going to tell you about a patient that you're seeing as the paramedic called to this scene. And it is a... called in as just a person with a witnessed collapse, but they've started CPR on them. It's a 58-year-old male. He's known to have some diabetes and hypertension. That's about all you know. But he was at home. His family saw him go down. So you arrive and you do find this adult male lying on the floor of their living room. They're doing chest compressions. So you take over that. You apply the defibrillator pads. You get access through an IO. You do a couple minutes of CPR, and at your first pulse check, you feel no pulse, and you see a rhythm of ventricular tachycardia. So you shock him once, you start CPR again, you place a supraglottic airway, and not too long after you resume chest compressions, your patient begins to stir. You start to see his arms moving a little. His eyes are open, and they were before to some extent, but now he's sort of actually tracking visually a little bit and really seems like he's looking at things in the room, perhaps even at you guys. Overall, just looking purposeful to an extent which is sort of hard to deny. It looks like he's awake. So much so that you're like, did we get Rosk? And this guy's awake now. And you actually pause CPR. But again, you see VTech. So you start CPR again. But as you do, he continues to move around almost to the point where he's sort of reaching for the arms of the compressor. Honestly, looks awake and even a little frightened. Really freaking everyone out, if not sort of interfering with the process, at least emotionally. So talk to us about what is going on. First of all, people who have never encountered this, it may be a completely novel phenomenon, but it is known. What is it? What are we calling it? What do we know about it? And you know, how prevalent is it, especially for people who have never seen this?
You have encapsulated every part of CPR-induced consciousness there, Brandon, very well. That's a ripping story to start off with. So we're calling that CPR-induced consciousness.
Is that, first of all, a sort of standard accepted term? Are we all calling it that?
At the moment, yes. CPR-induced consciousness, or CPRIC for short. There are a few other names floating around, depending on where you put the consciousness. Also, it's called consciousness during CPR in some of the more official manuals and things like that. But certainly from a literature point of view, CPR-induced consciousness is the vogue term. So going forward, why not? For those that don't really, haven't seen before, incidence-wise, look, it is a rare phenomenon at the moment. A large problem with CPR-induced consciousness is the myth around it is a lot of people don't get to see it during their medical careers. We don't have a lot of information around about. We're trying to collect as much data as we can and improve the data processes. But at this point in time, it's you're looking around, and from this is from Ambulance Victoria data, about 1% of all of our cardiac arrests have some form of CPRIC in them. So not a common phenomenon at the moment. And I think that's probably half of why what you encapsulated so well there with the emotional part of CPRIC playing on scenes is that it's not encountered often, and when it is a lot of thoughts rush through your mind. It is quite confronting. It's a really adds that cognitive burden out of the cardiac arrest scene, which is already quite high for all medical staff.
Why does it matter? You know, if it's something you encounter, is it just a interesting phenomenon, or does it affect what we do, or have any implications for prognostication or management or anything else?
Yeah, it matters. I mean, you take the small stuff, and I keep talking about, like, we haven't got a lot of data. It's not in the NCCN guidelines yet. We're not collecting a lot of data around it. But what we do know so far is that usually they're of cardiac origin. These patients, they're quite young, they're short downtimes. They're a cohort of patients that, as medical people, our eyes light up. That's the arrest that we can make a difference at. That's something we can have a really good outcome with. And you start VT, VF, PA, arrest, whatever, and this CPRIC occurs, the confronting nature, that emotional nature. So you've got that, the team dynamics automatically go out. Your leadership is quite difficult to get back. People are distracted. They're thinking, have I made a mistake? They'll stop CPR. There's delays to all the wonderful things we know work. CPR, shocking, IV management and antiarrhythmic drugs and things like that. Delays to management is a huge point. The distraction of the team is an even bigger point. And also, we can't look past humanely treating these guys. So there's some good studies going out at the moment where consciousness in cardiac arrest and memories from cardiac arrest are occurring. So there's that humane side of the picture as well, where sedating these guys and giving them some relief or sedation from everything that we're doing. Like, imagine waking up in the middle of a cardiac arrest and someone's doing CPR on you. It's quite confronting. Someone's putting an LMA down your throat, very confronting. So there's a whole host of reasons to treat, a whole host of reasons why it is important, and just mainly from a psychological point, from both sides of the fence as well. An extremely off-putting phenomenon, and one that probably needs to be controlled quickly, and so that we can get along with our cardiac arrest management.
So it sounds like maybe there are three categories of problems it can cause. One is that it just because it's such a strange thing to see, it may just delay appropriate care by sort of putting everyone off their usual algorithm. The second is that the patient actually could interfere with care, depending on how awake they are, in a more practical way. Maybe they push you away, you're trying to do chest compression, something like that. And then the third, just sort of ethically, is the idea that if we're doing unpleasant things to patients, we prefer to have them sedated to some extent, right? So they either have less perception of it or at least less memory of it. And those are sort of separate, right? I mean, you can imagine, if someone said the best outcome for a patient would be if you let them be as awake as possible, then you have to weigh that out. But I'm sure you'll tell us, hopefully we don't have to decide which way to go on that. But, and then I guess tying in with that ethical part is what happens to us as the resuscitation team, right? Because as unpleasant as it could be for the patient, it may also be so for the people taking care of them.
Your first, like, anecdotally, your first thing, I've encountered CPRIC many times now. And the first thing you think is, I've made a mistake. That's not VF on the screen. That's not VT. You automatically stop CPR. You completely off-put it. It's one of those, if you know, you know. And if you've really come across quite overt CPRIC, there's not many other things in the medical community that's taken me by surprise as much as CPRIC has in my career.
Is it fair to say, you said that to whatever extent we understand it, by and large, patients who this occurs in have other markers of a good prognosis, shorter downtimes and so on, which would make sense. Their brain is probably not as stunned. But is the mere fact that it occurred associated with an even better prognosis? Because it certainly seems like a patient who wakes up just from this low flow must have a pretty good brain. But that doesn't mean that every patient who has this will have ROSC and have a good neurologic outcome, right?
Yeah, 100%. So that's what the data points to at the moment, increased ROSC, increased discharge from hospital. Interestingly, the small amounts of data involved, there's a question around sedation and the effects that can have on outcome as well. So these guys generally, from what we have, are getting to hospital with increased ROSC rates far better than most. And as you're saying, that's a low flow state. So they are less cerebrally stunned. There is a better chance of getting these guys back, definitely, from just their short downtime alone.
Yeah. And anecdotally, it certainly seems like no one ever saw this 25 years ago. And the past 5, 10, maybe 15 years, at least we're hearing more stories about it, and maybe that's what the data shows as well. Do you think the difference is largely just that we're doing better CPR? I mean, is this a marker of the sort of perfusion we're able to get?
Yeah, it's. I think one of the markers, absolutely. High-performance CPR is making a difference. I think response times 25 years ago, perhaps, you know, most of the civilians... someone has a cardiac arrest at the shopping mall or something like that, and they collapse in front of them, most people wouldn't know how to do CPR. There's a growing trend in bystander CPR. There's defibs at scene these days at a lot of places, especially in Melbourne, Australia, where I'm from. So our pre-hospital systems are getting more efficient and getting quicker and getting to the patient quicker. And it stands to reason that therefore Cypriki's rates are increasing as well.
You just recently published a paper on this. You were the first author. Can you tell us in just a sentence or two what you guys set out to do?
So we wanted to solve some of the unknowns around Cypriki management. So in one sentence, we just wanted to come together, make a definition for Cypriki, make a management plan for Cypriki, and just kind of create a data template in which pre-hospital services, hospitals, whatever, can collect data to efficiently move forward in what we're looking at when with all these Cypriki presentations.
And you did this by, it seems like a Delphi panel. You put together an international group of experts, just sort of got everyone to agree on sort of the things we could agree with in the setting of the literature that exists, which is obviously all on the slim side.
Yeah, very slim side. Case reports at best. I laugh because the Delphi study was wonderful, but for those thinking about starting one soon, get ready for pain, lots and lots of pain. There wasn't a lot, so that's why we had to go to Delphi. And this study is the building block. It's consensus opinion. It's not the strongest of evidence out there, but it's something. And this is where we're going to try and start building our more stronger evidence-based guidelines and things like that from. Preceding this study was a scoping review that the same authors did, and we went around trying to find as many pre-hospital guidelines for Cypriki as we could. And we, through a grey literature search, we found about 23 including the ill-call guidelines. And basically, there was just a huge variation between treating with midazolam, ketamine, fentanyl. There was 23 guidelines, and of the 23, there were 20 different ways of treating Cypriki. So then otherwise, we had case reports to go off, so a bit of retrospective data analysis, but not a whole lot. So the Delphi study was really just put together to design a consensus opinion. And as you said, yeah, getting lots of people into a room or an internet chat box and getting them to do multiple surveys until someone agrees on something.
I certainly recommend everyone to read the paper if they're able to, but let's just try to summarize some of your recommendations. You know, you have a clinician who sees a patient in cardiac arrest and they see this phenomenon, what should they do? What are your recommendations as far as you're able to come to them?
Yeah, so management-wise, certainly seeing Cipric is the preferred treatment for is ketamine. It's important that the study kind of differentiated between with our descriptions. So a interfering Cipric and a non-interfering Cipric we had. For our interfering Cipric, it's everything you can think of. It's the pushing away, the pulling, the hitting, the talking to, overt symptoms that will physically stop a resuscitation in its place. And then you have your non-interfering Cipric, which is, you know, just those subtle signs that you were talking about originally, that eyes tracking, maybe taking a breath or two, maybe some slight movements and things like that. So important to differentiate between. And then the consensus is to use ketamine, and how much is too much comes into here, and all the talk and discussion around ketamine in critically ill patients at the moment, and its perfusion altering situation. So for a interfering overt Cipric patient, the recommendation is used 0.5 to 1 milligram per kilogram IVIO. And really the thought around that is put the Cipric symptoms down quickly, gain control of the scene, gain control of the patient, gain control of the team, and move forward. For non-interfering Cipric, a lesser dose, half doses, I think it was about 10 milligrams to 30 milligrams in bolus doses, and you can use whatever you want in terms of how much you want to treat it, and obviously you have to confer with all your medical staff on scene, just to more of a humane sedation bolus for analgesia and those kinds of things in that non-interfering category. Should the interfering first line not work, and that has happened before, we did run into a bit of a trouble with the Delphi study, agreeing on the second line management. And for second line, it really, we've kind of just left it up to local precedents. So the study was aimed mostly at pre-hospital services, and a lot of pre-hospital services don't have access to certain drugs that others do and don't. So we couldn't get anyone to really agree between midazolam, fentanyl, or a paralytic as a second-line agent. So we've just let it up to the local precedents. What do you guys use? And you can use it from there. So a follow-up to ketamine, it could be some fentanyl, it could be some midazolam, it could be a paralytic, depending on bias choice, I guess.
Okay. So first you stratify into, is this just they seem awake, or they seem awake and it is interfering with our resuscitation? And I assume the reason there is because if it's interfering, it warrants more a more aggressive approach, which, you know, otherwise, I guess I don't know that a more aggressive approach would be bad for them, but just in the principle of, you know, doing less to this tenuous patient, you know, less is better. And then in both cases, though, you would clearly suggest ketamine as a first line. You would just give more in the interfering patient.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, a large part of the feedback from the Delphi study was the dose of ketamine and the effect on perfusion in the critically ill patient. And you're talking about those, you know, we're getting it off RSI, critically ill patients and shock indexes and things like that. But a lot of people felt a large doses of ketamine and that non-interfering was counterintuitive and may have an effect on perfusion. That risk-reward profile started to go astray. Whereas for the interfering, definitely a large bolus needed. And to treat those three prongs of Cipric, that not only the humane aspect, but getting the team back on track and less distracted and less delays to management as well.
So if ketamine's available, that's what you would suggest. Is it really like only if it's not available, you would suggest another agent? And I think the two you mentioned are fentanyl and midazolam, but I guess it could be whatever.
Well, I mean, we're talking pre-hospitally, and we're quite limited with the amount of drugs, certainly from a hospital system. You could, you know, whatever you guys have, and there's many wild and wacky ones out there. Certainly from the study, yeah, ketamine definitely. If we like to keep it simple in the pre-hospital world, if it hasn't worked, the ketamine, then you move on. To me, anecdotally, and I could get in a lot of trouble in Australia for saying this, so just, you know, if you have to cut this out, you have to cut this out. It's probably against Australian law, but I think the New Zealanders have it right. And what they do is they follow their ketamine with a paralytic. So to me, going backwards from ketamine to a fentanyl or midazolam doesn't make a lot of sense. It's like hitting someone with a ton of bricks and then tickling them with a feather. Certainly you get it in an anesthetic dose to the patient straight away. So then it reasons to follow with, if that ketamine hasn't worked in that dose, then a paralytic's probably your next choice.
But you would never recommend a paralytic as a first line?
No,
that would sort of solve some of your problems. It would make them stop moving, but it obviously doesn't address the ethical side of it and maybe even makes that worse. So.
100%, yeah. It's and Ilcor, I mean, that's their Ilcor, when they gave out their recommendations, it was, look, we don't have a lot. Use what you want to use, what's your local sedation regimes. But the one real big recommendation they had was no paralytics on their own. And that just stands to reason. You've got such a high consciousness. And I cannot imagine paralyzing someone and letting them suffer through all the wonderfulness of a resus. So yeah, definitely sedation first, then paralytic. And it does come in as well, your service at a hospital level, not an issue, but at a pre-hospital service, it is that perhaps you might need intubating skills, which some pre-hospital services just don't have, and capabilities for end-tidal waveforms and things like that. So there is certainly a caveat to giving a paralytic. It is a little bit more complicated, but I think if ketamine hasn't worked, then that's where you got to go.
Do we know anything about the effects on outcomes, such as the chance of ROSC or longer-term outcomes, when we give sedatives to a patient in cardiac arrest, which obviously we don't usually do? Now we're talking about doing it. I mean, we would be very cautious giving any sedative to a patient who was in severe shock, for instance, and in a way that's what's happening here. On the other hand, I mean, the main reason, especially for drugs like ketamine that are a little more hemodynamically stable that we worry about in shock patients, is it kind of takes away some of their intrinsic sympathetic tone. And I don't know if these patients have any sympathetic tone. We're giving them all of their catecholamines extrinsically. So I guess I don't really know if it would have any negative or positive impact on them.
Yeah, it's a thought we've been pondering on quite a lot. And usually, you know, with all that catecholamine depleted patients, you're not really going to find them in the short downtime cardiac arrest who's just had a massive AMI type patient either. So, and you're right, we are giving them lots on top of that as well. So, that was the main concern of the study was sedation regimes and effect on perfusion. Ketamine seems to be the best at the moment that we can find hemodynamically. I talked about it a little bit before, shock index has been a great, this is the most shocked. The shock index doesn't really apply to the cardiac arrest, but they are very shocked. There's some papers coming out at the moment where, you know, the best prognosticator of perfusion in perfusion collapse and things like that is clinician gestalt. And I think that stands to reason here. If you've got this patient that has just gone down, from seems like a very cardiac cause, you know, they've clutched their chest and gone down in front of witnesses. It stands to reason that, look, we don't like to give huge boluses of sedation in cardiac arrest, sure, but in this circumstance, you're not talking about the patient who's been septic for a week or has quite a large brain injury, traumatic brain injury or something like that. And the clinician at the scene just has to make that decision and with the experience and knowledge on scene, as to how much they give. And that's why we have given that option of a 0.5 to 1 milligram per kilogram dose, where, you know, frailties, patient presentation, all those things have to be brought in and thought about properly before admitting. And it's that weighing up of, how badly do I need to control these symptoms? How distracting are they? How many delays are we getting versus what effect is my sedation regime going to have on the patient outcome?
And I assume there is no meaningfully controlled studies of any kind saying that if we give sedatives, it worsens the chance of survival or anything like that.
We are operating in the unknown for a lot of this stuff, Brandon. It's unfortunate. That's that we just need to get some more data and quickly. There's a very small kind of retrospective study by Alex Ellison, my partner in crime, for this study. And they looked at outcomes for Anders Victoria patients in Cipric and Ross grades and such and such. And at the time, Anders Victoria, I think, was using midazolam a lot for Cipric. We use fentanyl and ketamine now. But there was some suggestion from that very small kind of cohort study that the outcomes were maybe questionable versus not. So when sedation wasn't given, higher ROSC rates. When sedation was given, still higher ROSC rates than your normal, but less than if they didn't give any sedation at all. So it certainly needs to be looked at, and certainly we need to collect some data around.
Now, as a general rule, if I'm going to give a sedative of any kind to a patient in shock, I'm usually reducing the dose, both because of the potential risk and because they often just don't need so much. But, you know, these doses of ketamine, for instance, are substantial. I mean, I would expect these to, you know, fully dissociate most kind of awake, non-shocked patients. Do we just not know the right dose, or are you feeling like the risk balance is, if you're going to give them something, it should be enough that you can feel pretty good that it will probably be enough versus, I guess, inadequately dosing them multiple times or something like that?
Yeah, that's 100%. I mean, the little column A, column B there. No, we don't know. Yes, we'd love to know. Broken record, but collect data, collect data, collect data. But the second part of that is you want to balance that. I don't want to hurt your perfusion versus I need to control these symptoms quite quickly. Multiple doses. I've had an older lady, Game of Thrones style, trying to put out my eyes with her thumbs during CPR, scratching me, grabbing at my neck and telling me to go away in some not so very nice words. And that 6 minutes was an eternity for me. It took us 3 rhythm checks to completely dissolve. So we're giving her a sedative every time. We were giving quite small doses of fentanyl each time. At the time, that was our guideline. And the distraction that I had on the team, the amount of times that I stopped CPR thinking that I'd stuffed up and done something wrong was a huge impact. And one of the reasons why I'm so passionate on the subject is that was a profound experience for me. So there is that. It needs to be tackled quickly with some thought about what your sedation regimes are going to do to the patient's perfusion. They're already not in a great place to be, obviously, and it is a bit unfortunate, but that risk-reward profile, if they're left to cause disruption that really overt Cipric can cause, it can be quite detrimental to their entire management.
I was a philosophy major, so I have to ask these sorts of questions, but we're talking about consciousness based on the external manifestations of it. But it has to make me wonder if a larger number of patients are not experiencing some level of consciousness during CPR, just not so much that we're able to appreciate. They're not moving, but they are still awake. And while they're not interfering with the process, they are still having awareness potentially. And that kind of makes you wonder if some of these same considerations might apply. For instance, there are no small number of patients who have cardiac arrest and get intubated, sometimes paralyzed for that process, but not sedated because they're not in any way awake. And if they're not moving before, maybe we say, hopefully they're not awake, but perhaps they are. Do you think that there's like a subclinical CPRIC that might be an even larger phenomenon and we're just not seeing it?
Absolutely. There's a, and I, the author's lead name escapes me at the moment, but there's some great research being done over there in the States about, around that word consciousness, and patients, like obviously CPRIC is the end result of a physical physical manifestation that we can see. It's quite easy to pick up, but there are a lot of patients through this study. It was quite interesting. They were able to recall events and dreamlike states and recall what people looked like, the conversations that were had around them, even though they hadn't overtly shown anyone that they were conscious throughout. It's the AWARE 2 trial. And yeah, sorry, that author escapes me, but it's fascinating and it does kind of call into question the kind of, should we be giving sedation, maybe lightweight sedation in all cardiac arrests, whether or not I think that it should or not. But certainly if there's this higher amount of consciousness that we thought there was, and I think it's upwards of 30% of patients having recall from their cardiac arrest management, it does call into question, yeah, should we be introducing sedation regimes as a part of the protocol?
Perhaps if we're able to show that it's safe at least. But you said that a substantial number of these patients will have ROS because their prognosis is better if they have CPRIC. And now, of course, if people are following your guidelines, they may sedate them. But what if neither happens? What if you don't get the pulse back, but you also didn't sedate them? What is the natural history of this phenomenon? Does it tend to fade away over a prolonged resuscitation? Or at some point, do you have to decide if this awake patient, you should just stop CPR?
Overt CPRIC, like I was discussing before, the thumbs and the, I've had heard of patients grinding their fingernails off on the pavement and things like that. You, anecdotally, this is, you tend to get a ROS so quickly that you wouldn't really know if it's going to just stop by itself or not. And they were showing CPRIC signs up until we gained a ROSC in all those patients. So
it raises the question of whether we should ever stop resuscitation on a patient who is conscious. Because you said that many times you'll get ROSC anyway. If you don't, then presumably there's some underlying cause of this arrest, which we haven't reversed. But presumably also the neurologic function is still quite good. So another patient, we've been doing CPR, let's say for 40 minutes, I might say, it seems like we're not going to get a pulse back here. You know, let's set aside what sort of rhythms you're seeing and so on. But if that patient is still awake, part of me says we should never stop, which raises the question of what we do instead. But, you know, maybe then you start talking about things like putting this patient on ECMO or other measures like that. Because if the only problem is we can't get their heart to stop, but their brain works, that seems like the ideal candidate to do other things, you know, whatever weird and wonderful heroics come to mind, right? But that almost makes it seem like maybe we shouldn't sedate those patients so we could appreciate that. Because if I knock the person out, now I don't know.
Yeah. The conundrum. There's a great case study written, and I think it's from the 70s or 80s. I can't remember when. Where I think it's a 2-hour resuscitation in the hospital, and the whole time this patient is speaking to the point where they can communicate with them and have a conversation with this patient, and they're telling them that they can't get them back. And they get the family in to say goodbye and have that whole rigmarole go on inside the resus room. So there is occurrences of that happening, and you do raise a good point. It would be very difficult. I think these are the patients you throw the kitchen sink at, and if my thought around it is I'd rather sedate them, get the resuscitation going properly, but as you said, in, you know, if you're gone for 40 minutes and the resus is humming, but they're still not coming back and they're still showing signs of consciousness. Yeah, I think they are absolute candidates for ECMO and things like that. Until you can, we're treating the symptom, right? We've just got to try and find what the cause of that cardiac arrest is and see if we can reverse it. My only thing is at the pre-hospital level, it would be far easier. We're all about control in our state of chaos. So we'd much rather sedate. It does call into question, once you sedate them, you won't be able to see those signs of life anymore. But, I mean, you still should be going off your markers. They're probably in that low flow state, going to have quite high end tidals and other markers that you can. And if I was to come to hospital under CPR with a patient that was showing signs of CPRIC and still had quite high end tidals and the rest, I think our local hospitals would take that quite seriously as well.
It makes you think that really what we would ideally have is a way of monitoring brain function that is more sensitive than just outward activity, both so that we could appreciate it even if we sedated them, and also maybe for those subclinical people where it's not enough to make them move, but they're still somewhat awake. I don't know what that would look like, EEG or something that actually works, but that would probably be the gold standard, right? Rather than this very sort of insensitive tool of, is the patient like looking at me and giving me the thumbs down?
But that, I mean, that's part of the study was if signs of CPRIC do occur, full 45-minute resuscitation length and at a minimum, and then the decision to go to hospital under CPR and things like that.
Brian, what other questions do we have?
I don't know, man. I maybe have more questions than I did before, but this is such a fascinating thing for me. And I'm thinking back over, you know, 20 years or so of being in various roles in healthcare and, you know, thinking I've probably encountered this without knowing it, you know, because I didn't know it was a thing or whatever. But yeah, lots of potential ethical issues, like you were saying, with what do you do if kind of things. And I don't know. It's been an interesting discussion, but I don't know that I'm any better off now than I was before. Other than now, I'm going to consider sedating people.
There's ethical dilemmas and things like that. I think some people even talked about ketamine in a VS storm, electrical storm, sorry, and things like that. And would you use ketamine? Would you go to something else? And I feel uncomfortable treating the known unknowns before I treat the known knowns. And I think with these guys, sedation, until proven otherwise, that it's causing an effect on outcomes and things like that, is probably the starting block, and then we can move from there.
Jack, what else do you want us to know about this? What should we take away about this topic? We touch on some of the kind of takeaways. We emphasized how much we don't know. What should we close out with?
We're not expecting all of our patients to rise up and have a chat to us mid-arrest, but if they do, communications are key. Early sedation, control the scene, and, you know, the cardiac arrest is difficult enough to run from a team perspective, and getting those communication points out and really controlling every part of your scene. So CPRIC is going to be a large distraction in that, and the quicker you control it, the quicker you continue to communicate to all those around you, informing them what it is, that is the major point. And also a bit of holistic point of view as well. You know, we're using sedation, we're using everything else, but I think a chat to the patient at some point as well doesn't go astray. And if they have high enough consciousness to be showing you these physical signs, there is a chance that they're taking everything in that you're saying as well. So be mindful of our language, be mindful of what we're saying, and really, if you have a spare moment, have a chat to that patient and just inform them as to what's going on, and that you're going to take care of them, and those types of things.
Yeah, when you put it that way, while this seems like a very unique situation, in a way it's not, because we see people all the time who are critically ill and maybe at the end of their life, and we're balancing things like managing their symptoms, even though in some cases it could potentially have a deleterious effect on their outcome. Sometimes we're managing symptoms and we don't know if this patient is going to survive. And nevertheless, we feel like that is a good goal. And, you know, overall, just trying to remember that it is a person you're treating, which we are able to sometimes forget during CPR because they're not doing anything. We've just taken away that sort of comfort to us. And we have to say, oh, yes, it's still a person, even though we're doing this procedure on them. But we will link your paper in the show notes here and any other resources that you want to provide. But again, I encourage everyone to take a look. And I guess to reflect on this, you know, it's such a early area. I'm sure by and large, there are not, you know, local policies or anything else on this. Now you provided some sort of guidelines, but like so many low frequency things, it's good to just think about for you, you know, what are you going to do if tomorrow you go to work and you see this happen? You know, what fits in with your style of practice, your approach on things, your local norms and whatever else, availability of drugs and so on. So that, you know, it's not quite so confronting and you can have a plan and be a sort of source of reassurance and leadership to the rest of the team who very possibly is a little further behind that curve than you. All right. So thanks for joining us, Jack. We'll just remind everyone that none of this is medical advice, just some general education. None of us are representing our institutions, just providing our own opinions. And I hope you can correlate it with your own knowledge and other resources as well. But we'll leave it there and talk to you guys next time.